speak of it," I say fiercely. "You have never lost a battle. You never lose. You will be home within the week, I know it." "It's true," he says. "I have never lost a battle." He manages a grim smile. "But I have never come against Warwick himself before, and I can't muster enough men in time. But I am in the hands of God, and with his will we will win." And with that, he is gone. It is Easter Saturday. It is dusk, and the church bells of London slowly start to peal, one after another. The city is quiet, still somber from the prayers of Good Friday, apprehensive. A capital city which had two kings and now has no king at all, as Edward has marched out and taken Henry in his train. If they are both killed, what will become of England? What will become of London? What will become of me and my sleeping children? Mother and I have spent the day sewing, playing with the children and tidying our four rooms. We said our prayers for Easter Saturday, and we boiled and painted eggs, ready to give as gifts for Easter Day. We heard Mass and received Holy Communion. If anyone reports on us to Warwick, they will have to say that we were calm. They will say we seemed confident. But now, as the afternoon goes grey, we stand together by the little window over the river that passes so close below us. Mother swings open the casement to listen to the quiet ripples, as if the river might whisper news of Edward's army, and whether the son of York can rise again like a Lenten lily this spring, as he rose once before. Warwick has left his stronghold at Coventry for a heavy-footed march to London, certain that he can beat Edward. The Lancastrian lords have flocked to his standard. Half of England is with him, and the other half is waiting for Margaret of Anjou to land on the south coast. The witch's wind that trapped her in harbour has died down. We are unprotected. Edward collects men from the city and then the suburbs of London, and then he heads north to meet Warwick. His brothers Richard and George go with him and ride down the line of the foot soldiers, reminding them that York has never lost a battle with their king at the head. Richard is beloved of all the men. They trust him, though he is still only 18. George is followed by Lord Shrewsbury and his army of men, and there are others who will follow George into battle and don't care which side they are on as they follow their landlord. Altogether, they are an army of about 9,000 men, no more. William Hastings rides at Edward's right hand, faithful as a dog. My brother Anthony brings up the rear, watching the road behind, sceptical as always. It is getting dark, and they are starting to think of making a camp for the evening, when Richard and Thomas Grey, sent out by Edward to go before the army on the Great North Road to scout the land ahead, come riding back. "He's here," says Thomas. "Your Grace, Warwick is here in force, and they're drawn up outside Barnet, in battle formation, on a ridge of high ground that runs west-east across the road. We won't be able to get past. He must know we are coming. He is ready for us. He's blocked our way." "Hush, lad," Hastings says heavily. "No need to tell the whole army. How many?"
"I couldn't see. I don't know. It's getting too dark. More than us."
Edward and Hastings exchange one hard look. "Many more?" Hastings asks. Richard comes up behind his brother. "Looks like twice our number, sir. Perhaps three times." Hastings leans out of the saddle towards him.
"And keep that to yourself, too," he says.
He nods the boys away and turns to Edward.
"Shall we fall back, wait for morning? Perhaps fall back to London, hold the tower, set a siege, hope for reinforcements from Burgundy?" Edward shakes his head. "We'll go on." "If the boys are right and Warwick is on high ground, with double our numbers and waiting for us..." Hastings does not need to finish the prediction. Edward's only hope against a greater army was surprise. Edward's battle style is the rapid march and the surprise attack, but Warwick knows this. It was Warwick who taught Edward his generalship. He is thoroughly prepared for him. The master is meeting his pupil, and he knows all the tricks. "We'll go on," Edward says. We won't see where we're going in half an hour, Hastings says.
Exactly, Edward replies, and neither will they. Have the men march up in silence. Give the order. I want absolute silence. Have them line up, battle ready, facing the enemy. I want them in position for dawn. We'll attack with first light. Tell them no fires, no lights. Silence. Tell them that word is from me. I shall come round and whisper to them. I want not a word.
George and Richard, Hastings and Anthony nod at this, and start to ride up and down the line, ordering the men to march in utter silence, and when the word is given, to set camp at the foot of the ridge, facing the Warwick army.
Even as they set off in silence up the road, the day gets darker, and the horizon of the ridge and the silhouettes of the standards disappear into the night sky. The moon is not yet risen. The world dissolves into black.
That's all right, Edward says, half to himself, half to Anthony. We can hardly see them, and they're up against the sky. They won't see us at all, looking downhill into the valley. All they will see is darkness. If we're lucky, and it is misty in the morning, they won't know we're here at all. We will be in the valley, hidden by cloud. They will be where we can see them, like pigeons on a barn roof.
You think they will just wait till morning? Anthony asks him. To be picked off like pigeons on a barn roof?
Edward shakes his head.
I wouldn't.
Warwick won't.
As if to agree, there is a mighty roar, terribly close, and the flames of Warwick's cannon spit into the darkness, illuminating in a tongue of yellow fire the dark, waiting army massed above them.
Dear God, there are 20,000 of them at least, Edward swears.
Tell the men to keep silent. Pass the word. No return fire. Tell them I want them as mice. I want them as sleeping mice.
There is a low laugh as some joker gives a whispered mouse squeak. Anthony and Edward hear the hushed command go down the line. The cannons roar again, and Richard rides up, his horse black in the darkness, all but invisible.
Is that you, brother? I can see nothing. The shot is going clear over our heads, praise God. He has no idea where we are. He has the range wrong. He thinks we are half a mile farther back.
Tell the men to keep silent, and he won't know till morning, Edward says.
Richard, tell them they must lie low. No lights, no fires, absolute silence.
His brother nods and turns into the darkness again. Edward summons Anthony with a crook of his finger.
Take Richard and Thomas Gray and get a good mile away.
Light two or three small fires, spaced out, like we were setting up camp where the shot is falling. Then get clear of them. Give them something to aim at. The fires can die down at once. Don't go back to them and get yourself hit. Just keep them thinking we are distant.
Anthony nods and goes.
Edward slides from his horse Fury, and the page boy steps forward and takes the rein.
See he is fed, and take the saddle off him, and drop the bit from his mouth, but leave the bridle on, Edward orders. Keep the saddle at your side. I don't know how long a night we will have. And then you can rest, boy, but not for long. I shall need him ready a good hour before dawn, maybe more.
Yes, sire, the lad says. They're passing out feed and water for the horses.
Tell them to do it in silence, the king repeats. Tell them I said so.
The lad nods and takes the horse a little way from where the lords are standing.
Post a watch, Edward says to Hastings.
The cannons roar out again, making them jump at the noise. They can hear the whistle of the balls overhead, and then the thud as they fall too far south, well behind the line of the hidden army.
Edward chuckles. We won't sleep much, but they won't sleep at all, he says.
Wake me after midnight, about 2.
He swings his cloak from his shoulders and spreads it on the ground. He pulls his hat from his head and puts it over his face.
In moments, despite the regular bellow of the cannon and the thud of the shot, he is asleep.
Hastings takes his own cloak and drapes it, as tenderly as a mother, over the sleeping king. He turns to George, Richard, and Anthony.
2 hour watches each? He asks.
I'll take this one, then I'll wake you, Richard, and you and George can check the men and send out scouts.
Then you, Anthony.
The three men nod.
Anthony wraps his cloak around him and lies down near to the king.
George and Richard together? He asks softly of Hastings.
I would trust George as far as I would throw a cat, Hastings says quietly. But I would trust young Richard with my life. He will keep his brother on our side until battle is joined, and won, God willing.
Bad odds, says Anthony thoughtfully.
I've never known worse, Hastings says cheerfully. But we have Wright on our side, and Edward is a lucky commander, and the three sons of York are together again. We might survive, please God.
Amen to that. Anthony crosses himself and goes to sleep. Besides, Hastings says quietly to himself, there's nothing else we can do.
I do not sleep in the sanctuary at Westminster, and my mother keeps a vigil with me. A few hours before dawn, when it is at its very darkest and the moon is going down, my mother swings open the casement window, and we stand side by side as the great, dark river goes by. Gently I breathe out into the night, and in the cold air my breath makes a cloud, like a mist. My mother beside me sighs, and her breath gathers with mine and swirls away. I breathe out again and again, and now the mist is gathering on the river, grey against the dark water, a shadow on blackness. My mother sighs, and the mist is rolling out down the river, obscuring the other bank, holding the darkness of the night. The starlight is hidden by it, as the mist thickens into fog and starts to spread coldly along the river, through the streets of London, and away, north and west, rolling up the river valleys, holding the darkness into the low ground, so that even though the sky slowly lightens, the land is still shrouded. And Warwick's men, on the high ridge outside Barnet, waking in the cold hour before dawn, looking down the slope for their enemy, can see nothing below them but a strange inland sea of cloud that lies in heavy bands along the valley, can see nothing of the army that is enveloped and silent in the obscuring darkness beneath them.
Take fury, Edward says to the page quietly. I fight on foot. Get me my battle-axe and sword. The other lords, Anthony, George, Richard, and William Hastings, are already armed for the slugging terror of the day, their horses taken out of range, saddled and bridled, prepared, though no one says it, for flight if everything should go wrong, or for a charge if things go well.
Are we ready now? Edward asks Hastings.
As ready as ever, William says.
Edward glances up at the ridge, and suddenly says, Christ save us, we're wrong.
What?
The mist is broken for just a small gap, and it shows the king that he is not drawn up opposite Warwick's men, troop facing troop, but too far to the left. The whole of Warwick's right wing has nothing against them. It is as if Edward's army is too short by a third. Edward's army overlaps slightly to the left. His men there will have no enemy. They will plunge forward against no resistance and break the order of the line. But on his right, he is far too short.
It's too late to regroup, he decides. Christ help us that we are starting wrong.
Sound the trumpets. Our time is now. The standards lift up, the pennants limp in the damp air, rising out of the mist like a sudden leafless forest. The trumpets bellow thick and muffled in the darkness. It is still not dawn, and the mist makes everything strange and confusing.
Charge, says Edward, though his army can hardly see his enemy, and there is a moment of silence when he senses the men are as he is, weighted down with the thick air, chilled to their bones with the mist, sick with fear. Charge, Edward bellows, and ploughs his way uphill, as with a roar his men follow him to Warwick's army, who, starting up out of sleep, eyes straining, can hear them coming, and see glimpses now and then, but can be certain of nothing, until, as if they have burst through a wall, the army of York, with the king, toweringly tall at their head, whirling a battle-axe,
comes at them like a horror of giants out of the darkness. In the center of the field, the king presses forward, and the Lancastrians fall back before him. But on the wing, that fatal empty right side, the Lancastrians can push down, bear down, outnumbering the fighting York army, hundreds of them against the few men on the right. In the darkness and in the mist, the outnumbered York men start to fall as the left wing of Warwick's army pushes down the hill and, stabbing, clubbing, kicking and beheading, forces its way closer and closer to the heart of the Yorkists. A man turns and runs, but gets no farther than a couple of paces before his head is burst open by a great swing from a mace. But that first movement of flight creates another. Another York soldier, seeing more and more men pouring down the hill towards them, and with no comrade at his side, turns and takes a couple of steps into the safety and shelter of the mist and the darkness. Another follows him, then another. One goes down with a sword thrust through his back, and his comrade looks behind, his white face suddenly pale in the darkness, and then he throws down his weapon and starts to run. All along the line, men hesitate, glance behind them at the tempting safety of the darkness, look ahead and hear the great roar of their enemy, who can sense victory, who can hardly see their hands before their faces, but who can smell blood and smell fear. The unopposed Lancastrian left wing races down the hill, and the York right flank dare not stand. They drop their weapons and go like deer, running as a herd, scattering in terror. The Earl of Oxford's men, fighting for Lancaster, are on their trail at once, baying like hunting dogs, following the smell since they are still blind in the mist, with the Earl cheering them on until the battlefield is behind them and the noise of the battle muffled in the fog, and the fleeing Yorkists lost. And the Earl realizes that his men are running on their own account, heading for Barnet and the ale shops, already settling to a jog, wiping their swords and boasting of victory. He has to gallop around them to overtake them, block the road with his horse. He has to whip them. He has to have his captain swear at them and chivy them. He has to lean down from his saddle and run one of his own men through the heart and curse the others before he can bring them to a standstill. "The battle isn't done, you whoresons," he yells at them. "York is still alive. So is his brother, Richard. So is his brother, the turncoat George. We all swore the battle would end with their deaths. Come on! Come on, you have tasted blood. You have seen them run. Come and finish them. Come and finish the rest. Think of the plunder on them. They are half-beaten. They are lost. Let's make the rest run. Let's make them skip. Come on, lads, come on. Let's go. Let's see them run like hares." Driven into order and persuaded into ranks, the men turn and the Earl dashes them at a half-run back from Barnet towards the battle, his flag before him with its emblem of the streaming sun proudly raised. He is blinded by the mist and desperate to rejoin Warwick, who has promised wealth to every man at his side today. But what De Vere of Oxford does not know, as he leads his troop of 900 men, is that the battle lines have swung round. The breaking of the York right wing and their pressing forward of their left has pushed the battlefield off the ridge, and the line of battle now runs up and down the London Road. Edward is at the heart of it still, but he can feel he is losing ground, dropping back off the road as Warwick's men push them harder and harder. He starts to feel the sense of defeat, and this is new to him. It tastes like fear. He can see nothing in the mist and the darkness but the attackers who come, one after the other, out of the mist before him. And he responds with the instincts of a blind man to the rush of the men who come, and then come again and again, with a sword or an axe or sometimes a scythe. He thinks of his wife and his baby son, waiting for him and depending on his victory. He has no time to think what will happen to them if he fails. He can feel his own soldiers around him, giving way, as if they are being thrust back by the sheer weight of Warwick's extra men. He can feel himself wearying at the unstoppable approach of his enemies, the constant demand that he should swing, thrust, spear, kill, or be killed. In the rhythm of his endurance, he has a glimpse, almost a vision, it is so bright, of his brother Richard, swinging, spearing, going on, and yet feeling his sword arm grow tired and fail. He has a picture in his mind of Richard alone on a battlefield, without him, turning to face a charge without a friend at his side, and it makes him angry, and he bellows, "York! God and York!" De Vere of Oxford, bringing his troops in at a run, gives the order to charge, seeing the battle line before him, expecting to take his men into the rear of the York lines, knowing he will wreak havoc coming out of the mist at them, as good as fresh Lancaster reinforcements, as terrifying as an ambush. In the darkness they rush, swords and weapons drawn and already bloody, into the rear, not of the York soldiers, but of his own army, the Lancaster line, who have turned in the battle and are off the hill. "Traitor! Treason!" screams a man stabbed from behind, who looks round and sees De Vere. A Lancastrian officer looks over his shoulder and sees the most dreaded sight on the battlefield, fresh soldiers coming up from the rear. In the mist he cannot see the flag clearly, but he sees, he is sure he sees, the sun in splendour, the York standard, fluttering proudly over fresh troops who are running up the road from Barnet, their swords out before them, battle axes swinging, their mouths gaping as they bellow in their powerful charge. The banner of the streaming sun of Oxford he mistakes for the emblem of York. He and his men have soldiers of York before them, pressing them hard, fighting like men with nothing to lose. But more and more of them coming out of the mist from behind, like an army of spectres, is more than any man can stand. "Turn! Turn!" somebody bellows in a panic, and another voice shouts, "Regroup! Regroup! Fall back!" And the orders are right, but the voices are filled with panic, and the men turn from the York enemy before them to find another army behind them. They cannot recognize their allies. They think themselves surrounded and outnumbered and certain of death, and the heart goes out of them in a rush. "De Vere!" shouts the Earl of Oxford, seeing his men attacking his own side. "De Vere for Lancaster! Hold! Hold! In the name of God, hold!" But it is too late. Those who now recognize the Oxford standard with the streaming sun, and see De Vere laying about him in the middle of the confusion, and shouting to bring his men to order, think that he has turned his coat in mid-battle, as men do, and those who are close enough, his old friends, turn on him like furious dogs to kill him as a thing worse than the enemy, a traitor on the battlefield. But in the mist and the chaos, most of the Lancaster forces know only that an untold enemy is before them, pressing forward with soldiers of clouds, and now a fresh battalion has come from behind, and the darkness and fog on the road could hide more on every side. Who knows how many soldiers will rise out of the river? Who knows what horror that Edward, married to a witch, might conjure from rivers and springs and streams? They can hear the sounds of battle and the screams of the wounded, but they cannot see their lords. They cannot recognize their commanders. The battlefield is shifting. They cannot even be sure of their comrades in the eerie half-light. Hundreds throw down their weapons and start to run. Everyone knows that this is a war in which no prisoners will be taken. It is death to be on the losing side. Edward, stabbing and slicing in the very heart of the battle, William Hastings on his shield arm, his sword out, his knife in his other hand, bellows, "Victory to York! Victory to York!" And his soldiers believe that mighty shout, and so does the Lancaster army, attacked from the front in darkness, attacked from the rear in mist, and now leaderless, as Warwick shouts for his page to save him, flings himself on his waiting horse, and gallops away. It is a signal for the battle to break into a thousand adventures. "My horse!" Edward yells for his page. "Get me fury!" And William cups his hands and throws the king upwards into the saddle, seizes his own bridle, scrambles onto his own charger, and races after his lord and master and dearest friend. And the York lords go at a headlong gallop after Warwick, cursing him for getting away. My mother straightens up with a sigh, and together the two of us close the window. We are both pale from watching all night. "It is over," she says with certainty. "Your enemy is dead. Your first and most dangerous enemy. Warwick will make no more kings. He will have to meet the King of Heaven and explain what he thinks he has been doing to this poor kingdom here below.
My boys are safe, I think.
I am sure of it. My hands are curled into claws like a cat. And George, Duke of Clarence, I ask, what do you think for him? Tell me he is dead on the battlefield. My mother smiles. He is on the winning side, as usual, she says. Your Edward has won this battle, and loyal George is at his side. You may find that you have to forgive George for the death of your father and brother. I may have to leave my vengeance to God. George may survive. He is the king's own brother, after all. Would you kill a royal prince? Could you bring yourself to kill a prince of the House of York? I open my jewelry box and take out the black enameled locket. I press the little catch and open it. There are the two names. George, Duke of Clarence, Richard Neville, Earl of Warwick, written on the scrap of paper torn from my father's last letter. The letter that he wrote in hope to my mother, speaking of his ransom, never dreaming that those two, whom he had known all his life, would kill him for no better reason than spite. I tear it in half, and the piece that says Richard Neville, Earl of Warwick, I scrunch in my hand. I do not even trouble to throw it into the fire. I let it fall on the floor and I tread it into the rushes. It can be dust. The name of George I put back in my locket and into my jewelry case. George will not survive, I say flatly. If I myself have to hold a pillow over his face when he is sleeping in bed under my roof, a guest in my own house, under my protection, my husband's beloved kin. George will not survive. A son of the House of York is not inviolate. I will see him dead. He can be sweetly sleeping in his bed in the Tower of London itself, and I will still see him dead. 2 days I have with Edward when he comes home from the battle. 2 days when we move back to the royal apartments at the Tower, hastily cleaned and poor Henry's things tossed to one side. Henry, the poor, mad king, is returned to his old chambers with the bars on the windows and kneels in prayer. Edward eats as if he has starved for weeks, wallows like Melusina in a deep, long bath, takes me without grace, without tenderness, takes me as a soldier takes his doxy, and sleeps. He wakes only to announce to the London citizens that stories of Warwick's survival are untrue. He saw the man's body himself. He was killed while he was escaping from the battle, fleeing like a coward, and Edward orders that his body be shown in St. Paul's Cathedral, so that there can be no doubt that the man is dead. "But I'll have no dishonouring of him," he says. "They put our father's head on a spike on York Gate," George reminds him, "with a paper crown on his head. We should put Warwick's head on a spike on London Bridge and quarter his dead body and send it round the kingdom." "That's a pretty plan you propose for your father-in-law," I observe. "Will it not disturb your wife a little as you dismember her father? Besides, I thought you had sworn to love and follow him." "Warwick can be buried with honour by his family at Bisham Abbey," Edward rules. "We are not savages. We don't make war on dead bodies." 2 days and 2 nights we have together. But Edward watches for a messenger and keeps his troop armed and ready, and then the messenger comes. Margaret of Anjou has landed at Weymouth, too late to support her ally, but ready to fight her cause alone. At once we get reports of the rise of England. Lords and squires who would not turn out their men for Warwick feel it is their duty to support the Queen when she comes armed for battle, and her husband Henry is held by us, her enemy. People start to say that this is the last battle, the one that will count, one last battle which will mean everything. Warwick is dead. There are no intermediaries. It is the Queen of Lancaster against King Edward, the Royal House of Lancaster against the Royal House of York, and every man in every village in the kingdom has to make a choice, and many choose her. Edward commands his lords in every county to come to him fully armed with their proper number of men, demands that every town send him troops and money to pay them, exempts no one. "I have to go again," he says at dawn. "Keep my son safe, whatever happens."
"Keep yourself safe," I reply, "whatever happens."
He nods. He takes my hand and puts my palm to his mouth, folds my fingers over the kiss. "You know that I love you," he says. "You know I love you as much today as I did when you stood under the oak tree." I nod. I cannot speak. He sounds like a man saying farewell.
"Good," he says briskly. "Remember, if it goes wrong, you are to take the children to Flanders. Remember the name of the little boatman at Tournai where you are to go and hide?"
"I remember," I whisper, "but it won't go wrong."
"God willing," he says, and with those last words he turns on his heel and goes out to face another battle. The two armies race, the one against the other, Margaret's army heading for Wales to gather reinforcements, Edward in pursuit, trying to cut her off. Margaret's force, commanded by the Earl of Somerset, with her son, the vicious young prince, commanding his own troop, charges through the countryside, going west to Wales, where Jasper Tudor will raise the Welsh for them, and where the Cornishmen will meet them. Once they get into the mountains of Wales, they will be unbeatable. Jasper Tudor and his nephew Henry Tudor can give them safe haven and ready armies. Nobody will be able to get them out of the fortresses of Wales, and they can amass forces at their leisure and march on England in strength. With Margaret travels little Anne Neville, Warwick's youngest daughter, the prince's bride, reeling at the news of the death of her father, the betrayal of her brother-in-law George, Duke of Clarence, and abandoned by her mother, who was taken to a nunnery in her grief at the loss of her husband. They must be a desperate trio, everything staked on victory, and so much lost already. Edward, chasing out from London, gathering troops as he goes, is desperate to catch them before they cross the great River Severn and disappear into the mountains of Wales. Almost certainly it cannot be done. It is too far to go and too fast to march, and his troops, weary from the battle at Barnet, will never get there in time. But Margaret's first crossing point at Gloucester is barred to her. Edward's command is that they should not be allowed to cross the river to Wales, and the fort of Gloucester holds for Edward and bars the ford. The river, one of the deepest and most powerful in England, is up and flowing fast. I smile at the thought of the waters of England turning against the French Queen. Instead, Margaret's army has to drive itself north and go on upriver to find another place where the army can get across. And now Edward's army is only 20 miles behind them, trotting like hunting dogs, whipped on by Edward and his brother Richard. That night, the Lancastrians pitch their camp in an old ruined castle just outside Tewkesbury, sheltered from the weather by the tumbling walls, certain of crossing the river by the ford in the morning. They wait, with some confidence, for the exhausted army of York, marching straight from one battle to this next, and now run ragged by a forced march of 36 miles in the one day across the breadth of the country. Edward may catch his enemy, but he may have drained the spirit of his own soldiers and the dash to the battle. He will get there, but with broken, winded soldiers fit for nothing. May 3rd, 1471. Queen Margaret and her hapless daughter-in-law, Anne Neville, commandeer a nearby house called Payne's Place and wait for the battle that they believe will make them Queen and Princess of Wales. Anne Neville spends the night on her knees, praying for the soul of her father, whose body is exposed for every citizen to see on the steps before the altar at St. Paul's in London. She prays for the grief of her mother, who, landing in England, learned before her feet had dried that her husband was defeated, killed fleeing from a battle, and that she was a widow.
The widowed Duchess, Anne of Warwick, refused to go a step farther with the Lancaster army, and shut herself up in Bewley Abbey, abandoning both her daughters to their opposed husbands, one married to the Lancaster prince and the other to the York duke. Little Anne prays for the fate of her sister Isabel, tied for life to the turncoat George, and now a York countess once more, whose husband will fight on the other side of the battle tomorrow. She prays, as she always does, that God will send the light of his reason to her young husband, Prince Edward of Lancaster, who grows more perverse and vicious every day. And she prays for herself, that she may survive this battle and somehow come home again. She no longer knows quite what her home might be. Edward's army is commanded by the men he loves, the brothers he would gladly die beside, if it is God's will that they should die that day. His fears ride with him. He knows what defeat is like now, and he will never forget it again. But he knows also that there is no avoiding this battle. He has to chase it with the fastest forced march that England has ever seen. He might well be afraid, but if he wants to be king, he will have to fight, and fight better than he has ever done before. His brother Richard, Duke of Gloucester, orders the troop at the front of them all, leads with his fierce, bright, loyal courage. Edward takes the battle in the centre, and William Hastings, who would lay down his life to block an ambush from reaching the king, defends at the rear. For Anthony Woodville, Edward has a special need. Anthony, I want you and George to take a small company of spearmen and hide in the trees to our left, Edward says quietly. You'll do two tasks there. One, you'll watch that Somerset sends no troops out from the castle ruins to surprise us on our left, and you will watch the battle and make a charge when you think we need it. You trust me this much? Anthony asks, thinking of days when the two young men were enemies and not brothers. I do, Edward says. But Anthony, you know you are a wise man, a philosopher, and death and life are alike to you. Anthony grimaces. I have only a little learning, but I am very attached to my life, sire. I have not yet risen to detachment. Me too, Edward says fervently. And I am much attached to my cock, brother. Make sure your sister can put another prince in the cradle, he says boldly. Save my balls for her, Anthony. Anthony laughs and throws a mock salute. Will you signal in time of need? You will see my need clearly enough. My signal will be when I look like I am losing, he says flatly. Don't leave it till then, is all I ask. I'll do my best, sire, Anthony agrees equably, and turns to march his company of 200 spearmen into hiding. Edward waits only till he can see they are in position, and invisible to the Lancaster force behind the castle walls on the hill, and then he gives an order to his cannon. Fire! At the same time, Richard's troop of archers let loose a rain of arrows. The shot of the cannon hits the crumbling masonry of the old castle, and blocks of stone tumble down with the cannonballs on the heads of the men sheltering below. There is a scream as one man gets an arrow agonizingly in his face, and then a dozen more yells as the accurate arrows hail down on them. The castle proves to be more ruin than fortress. There is no shelter behind the walls, and the collapsing archers and falling stone are more of a danger than a refuge. The men scatter out, some of them charging downhill before they are given the command to advance, some of them turning towards Tewkesbury in retreat. Somerset bellows for the army to group and charge down the hill to the king's troop below them, but already his men are on the run. Yelling in rage, and helped by the fall of the ground, running faster and faster, the Lancaster troops hurl themselves down and aim at the heart of the York forces, where the tall king, his crown on his helmet, is ready for them. Edward is lit by a bright, merciless joy that he has come to know from a boyhood of battles. As soon as the Lancaster men plough towards him through the first rank, he greets them with his broadsword in one hand and an axe in the other. His long hours of training at the joust, on foot in the arena, come into play,
and his movements are as swift and as natural as those of a baited lion. A thrust, a snarl, a turn, a stab. The men keep coming at him, and he never hesitates. He stabs to unguarded throats up and under the helmet. He slices cleverly at a man's sword arm from the unprotected armpit upwards. He kicks a man in the groin, and as the victim doubles up, he brings down the axe on his head, shattering his skull. As soon as the shock of the impact throws the York troops back, the flank commanded by Richard comes in at the side and starts to hack and stab, a merciless butchery, with the young Duke at the very heart of the battle, small, vicious, a killer in the field, an apprentice of terror. The determined push of Richard's men breaks the onward charge of the Lancastrians, and they check. As always in the hand-to-hand fighting, there is a lull as even the strongest men catch their breath. But in this pause, the Yorks push forward, headed by the king with Richard at his side, and start to press the Lancastrians back up the hill to their refuge. There is a yell, a cold, terrifying yell of determined men from the wood to the left of the battle, where no one knew that soldiers were hiding. And 200, though it looks like 2,000 spearmen, deadly armed but lightly footed, come running rapidly towards the Lancastrians. The greatest knight in England, Anthony Woodville, far ahead in the lead. Their spears are stretched out before them, hungry for a strike, and the Lancastrian soldiers look up from their slugging battle and see them let fly like a man might see a storm of lightning bolts, death coming too fast to avoid. They run. They can bear to do nothing else. The spears come at them like 200 blades on a single lethal weapon. They can hear the howl of them through the air before the screams as they reach their targets. The soldiers thrash themselves to run back up the hill, and Richard's men follow them and cut them down without a moment's mercy. Anthony's men closing on them fast, pulling out swords and knives. The Lancaster soldiers run towards the river and wade across, or swim across, or weighed down by their armor, drown in a frenzy of struggling in the reeds. They run towards the park, and Hastings' men close up and hack at them as if they were hares at the end of a harvest when the reapers form a circle around the last stand of wheat and scythe down the frightened beasts. They turn to run towards the town, and Edward's own troop, with Edward at their head, chases them like exhausted deer and catches them for butchery. The boy they call Prince Edward, Edward of Lancaster, Prince of Wales, is among them, just outside the city walls, and they cut them all down in the charge, with flashing swords and bloodied blades among screams for mercy, without pity. "Spare me! Spare me! I am Edward of Lancaster! I am born to be king! My mother!" The rest of it is lost in a gurgle of royal blood, as a foot soldier, a common man, puts his knife into the young prince's throat. And so ends the hopes of Margaret of Anjou, and the life of her son, and the Lancaster line, for the profit of a handsome belt and engraved sword. It is no sport for the king. It is a deathly, ugly business, and Edward rests on his sword and cleans his dagger, and watches his men slit throats, cut guts, smash skulls, and break legs, until the Lancaster army is crying on the ground, or has run far away. And the battle, this battle at least, is won. But there is always an aftermath, and it is always messy. Edward's joy in the battle does not extend to killing prisoners or torturing captives. He does not even relish a judicial beheading, unlike most of the other warlords of his time. But Lancaster lords have claimed sanctuary in the Abbey of Tewkesbury and cannot be allowed to stay there or given safe conduct home. "Get them out," Edward says curtly to Richard, his brother, the two united in a desire to finish it. He turns to the Grey Boys, his stepsons. "You go and find the living Lancaster lords from the battlefield, and take their weapons off them and put them under arrest." "They claim sanctuary," Hastings points out. "They are in the abbey, hanging onto the high altar. Your own wife survives only because sanctuary was honored. Your only son was born safe in sanctuary." "A woman. A baby," Edward says curtly. Sanctuary is for the helpless. Duke Edmund of Somerset is not helpless. He is a death-dealing traitor, and Richard here will pull him out of the abbey and onto the scaffold in Tewkesbury Marketplace. Won't you, Richard?
Yes, Richard says shortly. I have a greater respect for victory than for any sanctuary.
And he puts his hand on his sword hilt and goes to break down the door of the abbey, though the abbot clings to his sword arm and begs him to fear the will of God and show mercy.
The army of York does not listen. It is beyond forgiveness.
Richard's men drag out screaming supplicants, and Richard and Edward watch their men knife prisoners who are begging to be ransomed in the churchyard, where they cling to gravestones, begging the dead to save them, till the abbey steps are slippery with blood, and the sacred ground smells like a butcher's shop, as if nothing were sacred. For nothing is sacred in England anymore.
May 14th, 1471. We are waiting for news in the tower, when the sound of cheering tells me that my husband is coming home. I run down the stone stairs, my heels clacking, the girls behind me. But when the gate opens and the horses rattle in, it is not my husband, but my brother Anthony at the head of the troop, smiling at me.
Sister, give you joy. Your husband is well and has won a great battle.
Mother, give me your blessing. I have need of it.
He jumps from his horse and bows to me, and then turns to our mother and doffs his cap and kneels to her as she puts her hand on his head. There is a moment of quietness as she touches him. This is a real blessing, not the empty gesture that most families make. Her heart goes out to him, her most talented child, and he bows his fair head to her. Then he gets up and turns to me.
I'll tell you all about it later, but to be sure he won a great victory. Margaret of Anjou is in our keeping, our prisoner. Her son is dead. She has no heir. The hopes of Lancaster are down in blood and mud. Edward would be with you, but he has marched north where there are more uprisings for Neville and Lancaster. Your sons are with him and are well and in good heart. Me he sent here to guard you and London. The men of Kent are up against us, and Thomas Neville is supporting them. Half of them are good men, ill-led, but the other half are nothing but thieves looking for plunder. The smallest and most dangerous part are those who think they can free King Henry and capture you, and they are sworn to do so. Neville is on his way to London with a small fleet of ships. I'm to see the mayor and the city fathers and organize the defense.
We are to be attacked here?
He nods. They are defeated. Their heir is dead, but still they take the war onwards. They will be choosing another heir for Lancaster, Henry Tudor. They will be swearing for revenge. Edward has sent me to your defense. At the worst, I am to organize your retreat.
Are we in real danger?
He nods. I am sorry, sister. They have ships and the support of France, and Edward has taken the whole army north. He bows to me and he turns and marches into the tower, bellowing to the constable that the mayor shall be admitted at once, and that he wants a report on the tower's preparedness for siege. The men come in and confirm that Thomas Neville has ships in the sea off Kent, and he has sworn he will support a march by the men of Kent by sailing up the Thames and taking London.
We have just won a dramatic battle, and killed a boy, the heir to the claim, and should be safe. But we are still endangered.
Why would he do it? I demand.
It is over. Edward of Lancaster is dead. His cousin Warwick is dead. Margaret of Anjou is captive. Henry is our prisoner, held here in this very tower. Why would a Neville have ships off Gravesend and hope to take London?
Because it is not over, my mother observes. We are walking on the leads of the tower. Baby in my arms to take the air, the girls walking with us. Mother and I, looking down, can see Anthony supervising the rolling out of cannon to face downriver, and ordering sacks of river sand to stack behind the doors and windows of the White Tower. Looking downriver,
We can see the men working in the docks, piling sandbags and putting water buckets at the ready, fearful of fire in the warehouses when Neville brings his ships upriver. If Neville takes the tower, and Edward were to be defeated in the north, then it all starts again, my mother points out. Neville can release King Henry. Margaret can reunite with her husband. Perhaps they can make another son. The only way to end their line for sure, the only way to end these wars forever, is death. The death of Henry. We have scotched the heir. Now we have to kill the father. But Henry has other heirs, I say, even though he has lost his son. Margaret Beaufort, for one. The House of Beaufort goes on with her son, Henry Tudor. My mother shrugs. A woman, she says. Nobody is going to ride out to put a queen on this throne. Who could hold England but a soldier? She has a son, the Tudor boy. My mother shrugs. Nobody is going to ride out for a stripling. Henry Tudor doesn't matter. Henry Tudor could never be king of England. Nobody would fight for a Tudor against a Plantagenet king. The Tudors are only half royal, and that from the French royal family. He is no threat to you. She glances down the white wall to the barred window, where the forgotten King Henry has been returned to his prayers again. No, once he is dead, the Lancaster line is over, and we are all safe. But who could bring themselves to kill him? He is a helpless man, a half-wit. Who could have such a hard heart as to kill him when he is our prisoner? I lower my voice. His rooms are just below us. He spends his days on his knees before a prie-dieu, and gazing without speaking out of the window. To kill him would be like massacring a fool. And there are those who say he is a holy fool. There are those who say he is a saint. Who would dare murder a saint? I hope your husband will do it, my mother says bluntly. For the only way to make the English throne safe is to hold a pillow on his face and help him to lasting sleep. A shadow goes across the sun, and I hold my baby Edward to me, as if to prevent his hearing such bitter counsel. I shudder, as if it is my own death that my mother is foreseeing. What's the matter? She asks me. Are you chilled? Shall we go in? It's the tower, I say irritably. I have always hated the tower. And you, saying such vile things as to murder a prisoner in the tower who has no defense. You shouldn't even speak of such things, especially not before baby. I wish this was over, and we could go back to Whitehall Palace. From far below, my brother Anthony looks up and waves to me, to signal that the cannon are in place and we are ready. Soon we will be able to go, my mother says comfortingly, and Edward will come home, and you will be safe again with baby. But that night the alarm sounds, and we all jump from our beds, and I snatch up baby, and the girls come running to me, and Anthony throws open my bedchamber door and says, "Be brave. They are coming up river, and there will be firing. Keep away from the windows." I slam and bar the shutters on the windows, draw the curtains around the big bed, and jump inside with the girls and baby and listen. We can hear the crump of the cannons firing, and the whistle of cannonballs in the air, and then we hear the thud as they hit the walls of the tower, and Elizabeth, my oldest daughter, looks at me white-faced, her little lower lip trembling, and whispers, "Is it the Bad Queen?" "Your father has beaten the Bad Queen. And she is our prisoner, as the old king is too," I say, thinking of Henry in the rooms below us, and wondering if anyone will have thought to close his shutters or keep him away from the windows. It would serve Neville right, and save us all a great deal of trouble, if he were to kill his own king with a cannon shot tonight. There is a roar from our cannons on their mountings before the tower, and the windows light up briefly with the blaze of the firing. Elizabeth shrinks back against me. "That is our cannon, shooting the bad men's ships," I say cheerfully. It is a cousin of Warwick, Thomas Neville, who is too stupid to know that the war is over and that we have won.
What does he want?
Elizabeth asks. He wants to start it all again, I say bitterly. But your Uncle Anthony is ready for him, and he has the London-trained bands ready on the walls of London, and all the apprentice boys, they like a fight, are ready to defend the city. And then your father will come home.
She looks at me with her huge grey eyes. She always thinks more than she says, my little Elizabeth. She has been at war since she was a baby. She knows even now that she is a piece on the chessboard of England. She knows that she is to be traded. She knows that she has a value. She knows that she has been in danger all her life.
And will it end then? She asks me.
Yes, I promise her doubtful little face. It will end then. 3 days we are under siege. 3 days of shelling, and then the assaults from the men of Kent and the Neville ships, with Anthony and our kinsman Henry Boucher, the Earl of Essex, organizing the defense. Each day more of my family and kin stream into the tower, my sisters and their husbands, Anthony's wife, my former ladies-in-waiting, all thinking it the safest place in a city under siege, until Anthony decrees we have enough officers and enough men for a counterattack.
How far away is Edward? I ask nervously. Last I heard, he was 4 days away, he says. Too far. We don't dare wait for him to come. And I think we can beat them with the forces I have.
What if you lose? I ask nervously. He laughs.
Then, Sister Queen, you must be Queen Militant and command the defense of the tower yourself. You can hold out for days. What we have to do is drive them back, now, before they start to come any closer. If they tighten the siege on the tower, or increase the cannon fire, or if, God forbid, they get in somehow, you could die before Edward gets home.
I nod.
Go on, then, I say grimly. Attack them.
He bows. Spoken like a true Yorkist, he says. All the York family are a bloodthirsty lot. Born and raised on the battlefield. Let us hope that when we finally have peace, they don't kill each other out of sheer habit.
Let's get peace first before we worry about the York brothers spoiling it, I say. At dawn, Anthony is ready. The London-trained bands are well-armed and well-drilled. This is a city that has been at war for 16 years, and every apprentice has a weapon and knows how to use it. The men of Kent, under the command of the Neville forces, are encamped all around the tower and the city walls, but they are sleeping when the postern gate to the tower opens, and Anthony and his men quietly file out. I hold the gate for them. Henry Boucher is the last to go. Your Grace, my cousin, bolt it behind us and get you into safety, he says to me. No, I'll wait here, I say. If it goes wrong for you, I shall be here to let my brother in, and you all with him. He smiles at that. Well, I hope we will come back with a victory, he says.
Godspeed, I reply.
I should close and bolt the gate behind them, but I do not. I stand in the gateway to watch. I think of myself as a heroine in a story, the beautiful queen who sends out her knights to battle and then watches over them like an angel. At first, it looks like that. My brother, bareheaded, in his beautifully engraved breastplate, goes quietly towards the camp, his broadsword in his hand, followed by his men, our loyal friends and those of our affinity. In the moonlight, they look like cavaliers on a quest, the river gleaming behind them, the night sky dark above them. The rebels are camped in the field by the river. More of them are quartered in the narrow, dirty streets around. They are poor men. There are a few with tents and shelters, but most are sleeping on the ground beside campfires. The streets outside the city walls are full of alehouses and whorehouses, and half the men are drunk. Anthony's force forms into three, and then, at the whispered word, everything changes. They put their helmets on their heads, they drop their visors over their kindly eyes, they draw their swords, they release the heavy ball of their maces, they turn from mortals into men of metal.
I somehow sense the change that comes over them as I stand at the gate watching. And even though I have sent them out to battle, and it is me they are defending, I have a feeling that something bad and bloody is about to happen. "No," I whisper, as if I would stop.